Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. We kick off this particular Wednesday with yet another weird law from around the world. We're back in the United States, this time around in the state of Massachusetts, according to Chapter 148 of Section 55 of the Massachusetts General Laws. It is a crime to manufacture, sell, or knowingly possess a golf ball that contains any substance that could explode or inflict bodily injuries. If you are found to be guilty of this, the first fine is up to $500. If you happen to become a repeat offender and do this again, you are looking at potentially a fine of up to $1,000 and imprisonment of up to 1 year. Interesting law. I wonder why someone would want to have exploding golf balls. Nevertheless, you're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at South Africa's investment positioning in the global markets, asking the question, is South Africa poised for a re-rating? There's a lot of factors that are going around both locally and internationally that could be proving to be beneficial towards South Africa. We're going to explore these with the chief economist at Investec, Annabel Bishop, and get a sense of what that potentially means for investment in South Africa. Then we've got a conversation with the team at Integrity 360, taking a look at cybersecurity breaches and how much they can cost South African businesses, and more importantly, how South African businesses can prevent these or better protect themselves from these. There's also a conversation with Nedbank around investing on the African continent, looking at the development and the finance that needs to go into investing on the African continent. We're going to explore that and see what we make of it. And then we're going to wrap up the show with an executive lounge conversation. We're going to be speaking to the senior vice president of ABB South Africa, Graham Abrams, and getting to know him a little bit better.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Given the day that we've had today, it's important to take a look at some of the market movements, as we always do. And I'm joined on the line by senior market analyst at XNS, Terence Hove, to see what we make of today's market movements. Terence, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Markets seemingly rebounding quite strongly today off the back of some sentiments from Fed Chair Jerome Powell yesterday that seemed to kind of allay some concerns and fears that markets have been processing of late, particularly with the re-escalation in US-China trade tensions. But today, markets across the board coming back and really appreciating the slightly dovish tone that the Fed Chair has taken.
Good evening, Jimmy. Great to be back on the show. I think that's been welcome by doves, of course. I think this comes back to where we were at the beginning of the year or end of last year, when we were going, when the outlook was more for, you know, cutting cycle that then got paused. So coming back to that, cutting cycle and emphasizing and reinforcing that, you know, the Fed is in a cutting cycle, you know, from the US Fed chair comments. I think that is reassured investors. Of course, it's played very well gold, for example, because when the rates come down, that tends to favor gold well. And I think the comments, what was more surprising is, you know, the strong dovish tone and the expectation of not just one, but possibly two rate cuts in for the rest of 2025. That would be October when they meet next in next week, and then in December as well. So that dovish stance and the strong dovish stance in with regards to it being two rate cuts instead of just one, I think it's also been quite a surprise for the market. And we're seeing that playing out well in the price of gold over and above the global risk factors that are there.
Terence, do you think the second rate cut that is now being spoken about by the US Fed is more of a pressure cut, or do you think this is something that they've looked at the numbers and said, well, we can afford to get two in? We know that the US Federal Reserve has been hesitant to cut over the last 2 years. We were promised six rate cuts last year. We were promised rate cuts this year. We've barely gotten them. Is this a decision made out of pressure, or is this a decision that's long overdue?
Yeah, I think to that point, Jimmy, we've been promised a lot of rate cuts before that never happened. So I think at times that they would mention that it's more the expectation that they're managing when they signal in that manner. Right now, I think we could lean towards perhaps the pressure. Why? Because it's a balancing act. Inflation is not nearly as down as they would want it to be from the US Fed's target. But it's a balancing act between inflation and protecting that jobs market, because the job market in the US has been very soft, and the weakness in that market is what they are trying and looking to support as well. So it's a balancing act. Given that jobs market weakness, that could force the Fed to move again in December, as compared to prior times when, as you mentioned, we were promised six, that never came through. At that time, the US jobs market was a lot more resilient than what it's showing right now. So that jobs market could support that narrative of that additional December cut needing to happen. But again, it's a balancing act between the inflation and supporting the jobs market.
Terence, let's look at some other economic data that has come out, or that's expected to come out as well. We got Chinese CPI data today coming through a little softer than what might have been expected, but we know that China has battled deflation where other countries have battled inflation. But I want to take a look at that, and I also want to take a look at the beige book that I know you keep an eye on that's set to come out later tonight from the US. The US hasn't been giving us much. We didn't get non-farms this month because of the shutdown in the US government. What are we making of the little bit of data that we are getting?
Yeah, it's very little data, as you mentioned, and very little can be done by way of focusing. Of course, other investment houses or banks will continue to utilize the tools that they have. So it's not like there won't be any kind of guidance out there in the market, but it's that official print that is missing. And as the U.S. shutdown continues, then the wait is going to be longer for that. I recall the week before last when we spoke about the possibility of it happening or not, and at that time it looked that they might avert the deadlock and avoid a shutdown, but it's 15 days in and it's still a deadlock. So that data, as long as it's not out there in the market, people or institutions are going to continue focusing with the tools that they have, but it will be needed to give concrete guidance as to where the actual official statistics are. The China, as we understand and as we know, it's currently in that full-on trade standoff with the U.S., and that's escalating. We're seeing that playing out as well in terms of that geopolitical risk in the price of gold. And it is escalating, and it's become retaliatory. So unless and until the U.S. president and the Chinese president sit down and have that amicable truce or compromise with regards to you know what is expected of each party and what the key negotiating points would be, in particular in this time, it's the rare metals that the US is responding to, that China has put a curb on. So yeah, I think that's going to stand out up until the two heads of countries are able to speak. And it's speaking to the significance of China in the global economy. As you mentioned, that key economic data that came out softer, it's also on that tailwind and economic play that's happening with this trade wars that's flared up over the past majority of 2025, really.
Terence, let's wrap things up with a look at the earnings. We know that banks have started to give us earnings numbers out of the United States. Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, all reporting numbers today. I believe Wells Fargo's in that list as well. How important are these figures coming through now? I see that when I look at Bank of America and Morgan Stanley, at least they've beat estimates and beat expectations. Is that something that markets are still looking towards to make some decisions around the strength of the international markets and perhaps the strength of the U.S. markets?
Yeah, certainly. And especially more so now, that's going to be very closely watched on the back of all the tariff wars that have been happening as I've mentioned, for March of 2025. That's also going to be a factor to see how much that sector has been affected by everything that's been going on. Again, we've seen that the equity markets through the indices such as the S&P 500, the Nasdaq 100 hitting all-time highs, and tech has been a big driver of that. So seeing where other growth opportunities are through these earnings from banks is also going to be an important factor for investors to see that other than tech, what else is driving growth in the U.S.? So that is very important indeed to that point.
Lots to still consider from a market's perspective. Markets having a relatively good day, and hopefully that momentum will continue. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Terence for those insights and for the time. Terence Hove, Senior Market Analyst at Exynos.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best Forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply. SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
With all of the global developments unfolding and some of the South African specific macro events that are still to come, I thought it might be worthwhile taking a look at the South African economic situation and whether or not South Africa is poised for a re-rating. Now, this is not a rating from the ratings agencies, but perhaps we are starting to look like an attractive investment destination once again. To take a look at this, I'm joined on the line by the chief economist at Investec, Annabel Bishop. Annabel, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of an overview of just some of the macro factors that are in the market at the moment and how these sorts of factors taken into account by asset allocators when they look for investment destinations.
Hi, thank you so much. Yes, so I think it's a very broad, sweep. And obviously, it depends, what exact area they're looking in. But I do think that, if you look through the lens of perhaps the last 10 to 20 years, South Africa has been seen to reduce in terms of investor destination. This is not just, as you know, because of the loss of our investment grade rating. And of course, that is important from a technical perspective, because some funds, as you said, they're not able to invest unless it's investment grade. So we can't get away from that. But of course, what's also key as well, what are the dynamics, what's been happening most recently, and some exciting news. We've obviously seen inflation coalesce around the 3% mark, the new target. We've seen some interesting commentary coming through from the Reserve Bank and National Treasury around that. But the bottom line really is lower inflation going forwards, which should mean structurally lower interest rates, much lower interest rates than we have. And of course, that's helpful from the bond perspective, from a foreign investor point of view, and also, of course, as well for people in South Africa living here from a long-term interest rate perspective. So, you know, these are good things that are happening. Of course, we did see the jump in investor sentiment, appetite towards South Africa after the successful formation of the Government of National Unity and the peaceful elections. And, you know, all of this has really led to lower bond yields for South Africa, closer to 9% versus, you know, 12.5% last year at one point. And of course, also as well, we've seen some improvement in bond yields in the US, which does help as well. So we can't get away from the fact that global financial markets are also key here. And that really is where there's a risk on, risk-taking environment or a risk-off environment. And of course, we've seen how periods of risk-off have really punished South Africa's assets, particularly the rand, and, you know, other portfolio inflows that South Africa typically would receive tend to reverse.
Annabel, speaking of South African assets, when we look at things like South African equity markets and you look at the South African rand, one could very easily make the case that South Africa is the best performing emerging market of 2025. And if you combine that with conversations out of the likes of the IMF and Moody's revising growth forecasts for the globe and for South Africa, the question then becomes, is South Africa then poised for even greater investment? I understand that, of course, there are still some factors that we need to get right that only South Africa can deal with. But does the investment case for South Africa start to look a little bit more attractive?
Without doubt, we've really benefited from a very, very substantial weakness in the US dollar this year. And of course, that came about on concerns around economic growth in the US. Worries that the high tariffs would obviously quell growth. And of course, you know, we have seen that translate through into significant rand strength. In fact, the rand has actually strengthened by less than the US dollar has weakened. So that's not due to South Africa on its own, but rather that, you know, we've benefited from these international market forces. And of course, if we do obviously have a look at where we're sitting in South Africa, you know, we've obviously also benefited as well from the global equity surge. Overall, what's really happened is that the US tariffs have come through much later in the year. Remember, they were originally expected to come through in early in April. And of course, that was delayed for 90 days. Then again, further delays as well. What this has really meant is that there's been very little of the year which has seen harsh tariffs from the US. And now we're talking about universal tariffs. And of course, that has obviously boosted, as you said, expectations around economic growth. But let's be cautious here. It hasn't been large jumps. If we were looking at, 0.9% for GDP growth for South Africa this year, we're now looking for 1% to 1.1%. So still very weak, modest growth, well below the 3% needed to structurally lift the economy and obviously, you know, really make a dent in unemployment. But returning to those growth figures, if you look at, you know, the 0.9 versus 1.1, that's really come about because the US tariffs were expected to take that much off our growth this year. In fact, if we actually have a look at the recent trade statistics coming in for South Africa, we can see that there hasn't been a major impact in terms of our exports, either in August or, you know, also since April as well, when we've seen the tariffs come through on the motor vehicle sector in South Africa. And these are individual sector tariffs. You know, we've actually seen vehicle sales year to date up over last year. So that really talks to resilience in South Africa's economy. And really on the back of that, you know, we obviously have seen South Africa managing to use alternative export markets. So, you know, this has really given a bit more comfort, I think. And as you said, internationally as well, the IMF and others have really pointed to also slightly stronger growth than previously expected, both because of the tariff delays and because of the resilience of many sectors. We've also, of course, seen stockpiling, increased inventory to try and smooth in the tariff effects. Really, we think that next year is going to be much more evident in terms of how the tariffs affect the world and South Africa. Lastly, you know, we've also seen commodity prices ease. And here we're not talking about the ones that typically are safe haven investments, such as gold. That's obviously gained in value very substantially up over 50% on the year, you know, coming as a consequence of this rise in, you know, worries around global growth, but also, of course, as well, the US interest rate cuts. But if you have a look at the broad base of commodities that South Africa exports, whether it's food, of course, iron ore, magnesium, chromium, you know, all of those factors, those actually have seen a moderation and they are a bit down. Our trade surplus for August was actually only 4 billion versus the previous month, 20 billion. So what we really really seeing is more of a sentiment impact. People worried about the effect of US tariffs, which has obviously quelled these commodity prices we're talking about and quelled a bit of demand. But the actual outcomes have proved to be more robust than was expected. And that's really, I think, the point that you and I are looking at, that there has been a little bit of an improvement compared to the worries originally about global US and South Africa growth. But as we know, not yet enough data to truly give us, you know, evidence of how bad the tariff impact may actually turn out to be or not.
Annabel, what about the outlook going forward? There are still a couple of factors that are lingering, the likes of South Africa potentially coming off of the grey list as soon as next week. We've been on there for about 2 years, but there are other factors such as us negotiating that trade deal with the United States. Our own Department of Trade, Industry and Competition has said that they're very near to concluding on that negotiation. Some of those factors that South Africa has the ability to influence through policy, through restarting the economy. As you mentioned, we need significant economic growth. How are they being read by investors at the moment? Because what it might appear is some investors are still potentially skittish on South Africa because there's still a level of uncertainty.
Yes, and I think, you know, that's very true of any emerging market economy. But some good news is that, you know, we've seen, we've heard quite a lot of commentary from people involved in sorting out these issues with South Africa, that we could come off the grey listing. You know, we've been on it for over 2 years. And in particular, it's actually would put us in a stronger position than where we were before we actually went onto it. So, you know, that is certainly something that is a positive outcome. I think as well, you know, if we actually have a look at other areas, we obviously said already we're expecting lower interest rates this year and next year. We only have one more meeting this year, but obviously going to next year. The potential trade deal, again, something that we can heavily influence. I think, you know, it's also as well against, you know, the lens of the geoeconomic environment, an important point, you know, that we've obviously seen some subsidence in the tensions in the Middle East. You know, you might say very substantial subsidence, but many political analysts are saying, you know, it's the easy part's been done, the harder part now is going forwards and ensuring the peace. But certainly as well, if you look at other areas of the world, you know, if we start to see de-escalation in geopolitic tensions, that would also talk to, as well, some improvement, I think, globally in risk, investor risk appetite. And for South Africa also in terms of negotiating its trade deals. I think that, you know, one thing we do need to always bear in mind is that these tariffs and, you know, trade policy of the US is very, very fluid. There's even a court case currently underway looking at the validity of US tariffs and whether they should remain in effect or actually be removed. And that's a court case in the US itself. So again, you know, there is that high level of uncertainty you're talking about. It does result in unpredictability. But as we move through the year, and obviously, you know, we've moved quite substantially through this year now into mid-October, it becomes evident that the effects that were feared have been less. And as we move into next year as well, let's not forget that severe tariff impact on the US would also reduce its economic growth and consumption. And there's a lot of worries around that. And that in turn could also see the US pull back on tariffs. So South Africa is an easy target to put tariffs on because we're not one of the key trade partners of the US. We account for less than 1% of its imports. But if we are generally seeing an improvement in trade relations around the world with the US and other countries, that would help us. But I think from an individual basis as well, what we've seen with the US administration currently in operation is that they do appreciate a lot of interaction and dialogue. And from that perspective, we think that South Africa could well make traction.
The optimism is there. Markets are starting to recognize that there is still an investment case for emerging market economies such as South Africa, but it is not all rosy as we might imagine. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done, and a lot of that work needs to be done before we can restore investor confidence. We'll leave this conversation on that note for now. Thank you so much to Annabel for those insights and for the time. Always lovely having you on the show. Chief Economist at Investec, Annabel Bishop, joining us to take a look at the investment case for South Africa and whether or not it might be time for a re-rating.
I think the family needs a break. We've always wanted a holiday home. Maybe we should see what's out there. Imagine waking up to an ocean view in a beautiful villa.
With a big braai area and a spare room for when family visits. If it's on your mind, it's on ours. Partner with a wealth banker will connect you to a home loan with up to prime minus 1.5%. See money differently. Nedbank Private Wealth. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we have previously covered the importance of cybersecurity in some of our other shows, but there was an alarming statistic put out by IBM that suggests that the average cost of a data breach for a South African organization is 41.1 million rand. Now, for more on this, we're going to be taking a look at just all of the intricacies around cybersecurity and the importance of cybersecurity with the Global Chief Technology Officer at Integrity 360, Richard Ford. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Richard, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. 40 million rand is a staggering amount for any business, much less businesses that often found to be a lot smaller than other businesses. Why is the cost of a cyber attack so high?
Yeah, thank you. And it's great to be on. And obviously, it's 41 million rand in South Africa. I think, you know, I'm going to give a little bit of comfort first that you've got to put that number into perspective. Obviously, that's coming from IBM. And if you look at, you know, how they're building that number, that's going to be from the information they get from the organizations they're responding to, which does disproportionately put it towards those much larger organizations. Now, that's not to say that we don't need to worry about that whatsoever, but we do need to think about that. And I think I looked at a report in the UK from the UK government that looks across particularly all of the businesses, and actually that cost of data breach, particularly in the smaller business, is around £12,000, which is obviously a much smaller number, but obviously a much smaller organisation. But there are massive outliers in that. We only have to look at some of the high-profile breaches that actually, unfortunately, have been in the UK of late, like Marks and Spencer's, you know, wiped half a billion off their share price, costing them 50 million a week. We look at Jaguar Land Rover, ground to complete halt to the point of where the UK government's had to step in to support their supply chain. So that impact is absolutely massive for those organizations. And actually, it filters down. You know, take that Jaguar Land Rover example. You know, it's not just them being hit. It's all of their partners being hit as part of that cyber attack. So when you add all those bits together, then you can actually easily see, you know, we do get to that sort of staggering high costs of a data breach. And in terms of answering that question, you know, why are we at those kind of those figures? It's the effectiveness and impact that we're seeing. You know, more and more, you know, we've seen, and actually almost like a roundabout turn in terms of tactics. You know, initially, when we had WannaCry, which is probably the first bit of ransomware that made the headlines, it was focused on, you know, impacting machines, preventing, you know, encrypting them, preventing you from using them. But quickly, you know, cybersecurity threat actors moved on to stealing data and using that as their extortion lever, as what we call double extortion. We then got triple extortion. You know, when we weren't responding to the data that's been stolen, they go use that data to go to your customers, to your partners, to get them to add a little bit more of a lever on top for them to pull. And now we've gone right back round to focusing on massive impact, you know, shutting systems down. And actually, a lot of it is control systems, you know, where it's a huge impact on the business and stopping that business from operating. And then very quickly, you can see how you end up at 41 million rand.
Richard, for the longest time, a lot of the weaknesses that have been identified within these sorts of cyber attacks have been down to, in the case of phishing scams, in the cases of embedding malware, have been down to sort of human error and sort of a low human firewall, for lack of a better term. Is that still the case? Is the main point of failure the employees within a business or the human aspect of the interactions?
Yeah, I don't like to think about it as the point of failure or our users and humans being that weakest link. I think that is the way that that it's viewed. We've got to completely flip that. They are our first and best line of defense. And that reason, as you say, is because a lot of the time they are targeted. You know, social engineering is, you know, one of the primary ways that that hackers get into organizations. And we've seen that with those breaches that I talked about, and I won't go into too much detail there. But in fact, actually, I only did a webinar as part of Cybersecurity Awareness Month for end users everywhere. And this morning, this is exactly what we talked about. Now, that perception does come down to behaviors. And in fact, actually, Gartner, who are a business and technology research and analyst, they did a survey of end users and their approach and behaviors when it came to security. And actually, 67% of the people that responded said that they used the same password across multiple platforms, which we all know is a big no-no. I think it was 65%, and they quite happily open emails from and attachments from users that they and people they don't know. Again, something that we wouldn't do. But the probably the most important stat that you can take from that survey is that 93% knew that these actions caused enterprise risk and risk to our data, but they did them anyway, which kind of talks to, well, actually, we need to not say, well, they're the weakest link. Actually, how can we support better? How can we make sure that we have a culture where they're happy to challenge, where they're happy to raise their hand? It's not going to be punitive punishment for clicking on a link or opening a file. There's nothing worse, you know, from an incident response perspective. When you're responding to an incident, you want to know as soon as possible to limit the impact and understand exactly where it came from. There's nothing worse than people just sitting there fearing for their job or shame and embarrassment across the company than not reporting it. The other side of it, actually, there's a big, you know, everyone talks about AI, so I'm not going to miss the opportunity, but AI is playing a big part in social engineering. You know, where we used to get poorly written emails that we could spot the grammar was off, now we can chuck them into ChatGPT, and you can speak any language you like fluently, and also your grammar is absolutely perfect and language is perfect. So it's becoming a lot more convincing. And we actually saw that there was an over 4,000% increase in phishing emails after the advent of ChatGPT. And I think that speaks volumes.
So, Richard, it sounds as though we need to be moving more from an awareness state within organizations to taking action. One of those actions, as you rightly mentioned, is remembering that the employees within a business are the first line of defense, and therefore certain actions on their part could be the difference between financial ruin for a business and preventing a serious cyber attack. What are some of the other actionable steps that businesses can take to protect and insulate themselves?
Yeah, so there's a huge amount of steps. You know, there's plenty of, you're talking to a CTO, so I could give you plenty of technology answers, but most of them are people and process. I mean, you need to take a very secure approach to cybersecurity and think about the full life cycle, that we understand what we're protecting, where our data is, that we understand how it's going to be attacked, putting those controls in place, whether it's people, process, technology, but being mature and saying, you know, as much, we can spend as much money as we like. You know, we've seen it from big organizations that a breach is likely to happen at some point. So it's not an if, it's a when, and we need to be able to detect that. So a lot of organizations are investing in managed detection and response services because, you know, there is I think it's currently 4 million shortfall in cybersecurity resources globally. And I believe it's 3,000 across the continent of Africa, that we have a shortfall in people, we have a shortfall in skills. So people are looking at, you know, services that they can consume. And one of those has to also be incident response. You know, if we do get hit by an incident, the speed that we respond to is critical. We talked about those users and how they can impact that. And obviously spotting and flagging an incident is important. The current dwell time for an incident, we used to talk about it being in hundreds of days before a threat actor was identified or they acted on their intentions. We're now down into 10 days. Part of that's that we've improved our way of identifying them, but also it's the speed that they move at. And when something does happen, we've got to be prepared, or organizations have to be prepared, top to bottom, and have a clear incident response plan in place. So everyone knows their roles, responsibilities. When we're responding to incidents, one of the biggest impacts, apart from, you know, not getting flagged quick enough, is an organization not being prepared to take actions that they need to. There's a whole crisis management topic. But if there's one thing that I'd recommend after getting an incident response plan in place, is to actually test it. And that's not just a technical test. Are we going to respond? Probably the most important people are the exec level that are going to make serious decisions about their business, because it may be like the co-op in the UK. They chose to pull the plug, take the hit themselves to limit the impact. And you know, that is not something that somebody in the security team is going to make. That is a business decision. So testing that, walking through a tabletop exercise, really preparing the team from top to bottom to respond to an incident is absolutely critical.
The importance of being prepared cannot be overstated, especially where it relates to cybersecurity matters. The last thing you want is to find yourself on the receiving end of a cyber attack with no plan to get out of it. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Richard for those insights and for the time. Richard Ford, a Global Chief Technology Officer at Integrity 360, joining us to take a look at cybersecurity and its importance in the modern era.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by Nedbank, leaders in renewable energy finance. As we near closer towards the G20 gathering or the G20 summit that will take place in November, we start to reflect on the G20 presidency that we have held as South Africa throughout the year. This has been lauded as Africa's G20, and a lot of the conversation has centered around the development of the African continent. We're going to take a look at what that means at this stage and how we continue to progress that. I'm joined on the line by the Group Managing Executive at Nedbank's Rest of Africa and subsidiaries, Dr. Terence Sibiya, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Dr. Sibiya, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Africa's G20, as many have called it, is quite a historic moment for the country of South Africa as the hosts, but also for the African continent. What does this mean for the continent, but what does it mean as well for the likes of Nedbank and other businesses that operate on the continent?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to the listeners. Thank you for having me. Jimmy, this is a defining opportunity for Africa. I listened with interest to Annabelle's chat with you a little while ago, and she did mention in her closing remarks that inflation is calming, for instance. Africa's growth is projected to be higher than last year. And while we don't quite know, and I think she alluded to it, we don't quite know what the trade tariffs are going to mean, I think we've largely averted a full trade war. Doesn't mean we're out of the woods, but the reality is that we seem to have avoided a full trade war. So it's a defining opportunity for Africa to sort of move through this G20 process and the presidency from what we've previously experienced as influence and inclusion to shaping some of these new global financial rules. So it's a symbolic moment for the world, for Africa, where Africa will be in the center of how we shape and how we participate and get into the central part of the gravity of the shifting dynamics globally, particularly given the current geopolitics we see right now. So from our perspective as Nedbank, this is a seminal moment for us, and we've participated in some of the G20 activities leading up to November, including digital finance and also climate funding. So from our perspective, we see this as an opportunity for us to help design the system and design the future of the global financial system through this G20 presidency, Jimmy.
Dr. Sibiya, for many years, the African continent has almost been left out of these sorts of conversations, particularly from an influence perspective and an inclusion perspective. And you touched on both of those factors, saying that we are in a transition phase between one and the other. How does that then practically start to play itself out? I mean, projects on the African continent are seemingly drawing more international interest. Countries on the African continent themselves are starting to say, perhaps we need to prioritize our own needs. How is that practically manifesting in what we're seeing on the continent?
Well, what practically that means, Jimmy, is for us to actually rise to the occasion. We are seeing that Africa has a history of systemic underdevelopment that's generally required structural financing, but it hasn't closed this $170 billion infrastructure gap, for instance, that we see on the continent. So we see an opportunity for us to actually shape and participate and use finance as a lever for development. That's the perspective we're taking. For instance, Nedbank has already directed about 189 billion rands of its lending book towards some of the SDG-aligned investments, for instance. That would include maybe 47 odd billion in renewable energy, 29 billion in agriculture, and roughly 3 billion in water and sanitation. So we've decided to use this opportunity to bring attention to finance being a focus around transformation, not just transactions. So we have to back these long-term and inclusive growth goals that will ultimately build heavy resilience and good opportunities for all Africans. So we're generally moving from inclusion to influence, Jimmy. That's really the perspective that we see this opportunity, this transitional opportunity as.
Dr. Zubia, I want to take a look at the finance aspect of it. Infrastructure development, you mentioned the infrastructure gap, finance on the African continent and finance for the development of Africa has historically been rather difficult conversation and also a rather expensive conversation. We saw as recently as this week the President of the Republic, who is also the de facto president of the G20 presidency, President Ramaphosa, mentioning that Africa and the debt that Africa has had to accumulate over the years, that needs to be re-looked at when we look at financing on the continent. Take us through the importance of financing, especially if we're to use it as a lever or a catalyst towards development.
Yes, that's a very good question and a very good observation. And I did mention that we've got this history of systemic underdevelopment, that we actually need to relook at the whole system and lobby for a reorientation that this global financial system we've been part of, it must work differently for the continent. We have our own nuanced needs per region, per country, per local systems. So we must look at, yes, there's global SDGs that we can use as guidance. But in order to close this infrastructure gap you're looking at, we need to actually shift from being short-term in our views and looking at short-term capital flows towards funding more transformational sectors like energy, infrastructure, logistics. We know in South Africa we have a particular focus on logistics. And then, of course, the digital infrastructure. And we cannot ignore, obviously, the climate transition. So it is part of an opportunity to reorient and get the Global South, using this leverage that we have right now in the G20 presidency, to reorient a global financial system that works and shifts Africa's call for inclusion and taking some of the reins in terms of co-creation and contributing actively to the global financial governance so that we can actually participate more inclusively rather than all is being spoken for or being cap in hand, pretending or posing as cap in hand, Jimmy.
Dr. Zubia, as we wrap up the conversation, what do we then look ahead to from an African continent perspective? This is, as you mentioned at the start of the conversation, a very unique opportunity that the African continent finds itself in. It's a unique opportunity to reestablish the rules of engagement, so to speak, and to show the world that we are ready to take the lead and we are ready to take charge of certain things. Is that the message that we go into the November summit with? Is there another message that we get across to the world as a continent?
A couple of key things there, Jimmy, that I would, if we just now look ahead and how we leverage this opportunity. And this will be a message to the world, not just to Africa in its own right. We are capable, we are credible, and we're looking for collaboration and not asking for assistance, but offering solutions. We have very strong institutions. Our banks are well capitalized. For instance, Nedbank has a CET1 ratio, for instance, of 13.1%. This is proof that we have the resources that can finance the growth responsibly. So in essence, as a parting shot, Africa's not waiting for change, but we want to engineer it with the rest of the world, and we want to do it now from within and inclusively. So from our perspective, we always say as Nedbank, we use our financial expertise to do good for people, for planet, and for prosperity. So that's a key message that I hope will resonate as we begin receiving visitors through the G20 presidency, Jimmy.
It's certainly going to be a colourful end to the year and a chance for us as South Africa and as the African continent to showcase to the world, as Dr. Zubia rightly mentioned, that we are ready and we are capable. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Dr. Terence Sabia, Group Managing Executive for Nedbank's Rest of Africa and Subsidiaries, taking us through the opportunity that lies on the African continent for development and how we leverage our position within the G20 to achieve it. This interview was brought to you by Nedbank. Power progress with Nedbank, a proud sponsor of B20. As proud sponsors of the B20 Summit, Nedbank is at the forefront of Africa's energy transition. With 47 billion rand invested in renewable energy projects, Nedbank has financed 5 gigawatts of clean energy capacity. This proves that Nedbank doesn't just fund transformation, they fuel it by shining a light on Africa and its power. See money differently. Nedbank. Nedbank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday. We have the pleasure of speaking to leading executives in and around the world and getting to know them a little bit better beyond their day-to-day responsibilities. This week's executive is the Senior Vice President at ABB South Africa, Graham Abrahams. He joins me on the line now to get to know him a little bit better. Graham, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did you end up at ABB?
Well, it happened 23 years ago now, so I was a sales representative in another organization selling a specific product that was purchased by ABB globally. And ABB was actually a customer of mine at the time. And then with the global acquisition that took place, they sent some senior people to South Africa to have a discussion. There was two or three agencies. They decided they liked our company the best. And then it was myself and two other people that were selling the product at the time, and we were pulled into the ABB organization. And that's really where it started, as a junior sales rep selling a product that used to cost 5 rand and 6 cents. So a long time ago, but yeah, that's how it all started.
So basically you were so good that they had to buy you with the company. Okay.
Yeah, at that stage we had quite a good sales setup running, and you know, operationally it also worked quite well. So they lifted and shifted all three of us. So there was two salespeople and a manager that they brought into ABB, and then we just accelerated from there, you know.
Graham, do you enjoy sales?
I love sales. I think it's the most it's extremely challenging, but it's also very, very rewarding. You know, I love building relationships with people, and I think sales is all about that. You know, you get to meet various different people, but you also get to, you know, you get to have fun at the same time. So it's challenging, but also very exciting.
What's the one thing you would change about the sales environment if you could?
The sales environment, I would probably, if there was a magic wand, I'd want people to value quality a little bit more. I think, you know, the world we're moving into today is a little bit scary for me. When selling a quality product, you have to be quite exceptional at it, because there's so much inferior quality products available at the moment, and people fall victim to that. And in the long run, it's detrimental to the customer. And quite often they come back to us saying, oh, we've tried our hand here and it hasn't really worked. So if I could change the one thing, is that people valued quality a little bit more.
Graham, speaking of quality, what does a quality day out look like to you when it's not involving work?
A quality day out without work, it would probably be with my family. I'm very fortunate to have both my parents still. They're 80 years old, so we try and spend as much time as possible with them. But it would be with my son and my wife, and probably in the bush somewhere, relaxing.
Okay, so Graham, then you'd be the best to ask this question too. You're going camping. Are you fussy about your camping setup? I know a lot of people, and so much so that there's a whole term now called glamping, where people refuse to camp under certain conditions. Are you that fussy about your camping?
Look, camping started for me, it was myself and my wife. So it started with the two of us in a two-man tent. And we've accelerated, fortunately, or we've grown from that perspective. So I have a little off-road trailer, a little camping trailer now, and it does have its own little shower and its own little amenities and stuff. So I would say at the age that I've got to now, I can't imagine myself lying, you know, on a blow-up mattress in a two-man tent. I think that would be quite tough. So I think in short, the answer is I think glamping would maybe take it one step too far. I think we're comfortable. And one thing I really enjoy about camping is it's a very affordable holiday. You know, it's actually quite interesting you'll be speaking like this. I was in the Kruger Park last week. And, you know, it becomes extremely affordable, you know. So for me, I think as long as you've got the basics where you've got a comfortable bed and you've got one or two things that make things easier, you know, especially for your wife. If you get that part right, then camping, you doesn't have to really be too glamperish, you know.
Having your priorities in order is absolutely essential. Graham, what's your go-to camping meal?
Go-to camping meal would be a lamb chop, a piece of boerewors, and some vegetables or a salad. So my wife, we try to eat as healthy as we can. So for us, cooking meat on a fire is always, it just adds to the ambiance. You start the fire as the sun's going down. You know, generally you have something nice and cool to drink. She's making the salad or cooking a vegetable or two, and it's just absolute bliss looking at the sun go down. So that would be a perfect evening and a meal for us.
Graham, the team that you work with, would they be surprised to know that you're an avid camper? Is there something that you've perhaps kept a hidden secret from them that they don't know about you?
No, I think they're aware. So it's quite interesting. My wife used to work at ABB, where I'm employed, many years ago. So she's connected with a lot of colleagues that are still working with us. So she loves to post stuff on social media, so they all know. They all see the pictures, and I walked down the passage 2 days ago, and one of the guys says to me, "Oh, it looks like you had such a great camping trip." And I think, geez, how do you know this stuff, you know? So I don't think too many of them would be surprised. I think they're all aware, and they've seen, you know, seen how we get it done. So, yeah, it's all good.
Graham, I understand you're traveling at the moment. Where are you headed to?
I'm actually on my way to go and play a game of paddles with compatriots, guys from the office. So there's three of us that are having a game of paddle, and it gets quite intense because it's a different business area of ABB, so it's obviously very intense, but yeah, it's good fun. It's trying to get the heart rate up and get the muscles moving a bit.
Graham, if you had to choose paddle or golfing, you can only have one.
Oh goodness, that would be golf for sure. I love golf. I've played golf since school, you know, so I really do enjoy it, and I play a lot, and I haven't quite done paddle with a customer yet, but we probably will. But golf is definitely something I do a lot with customers because it's a great place to connect, and you can have some business discussions, but in an informal way, which generally it's a bit more relaxed. And yeah, it's just a great place to entertain customers and spend some time building relationships with them. So it would have to be golf, eh?
Graham, this is a safe space. What's your handicap?
I think it's 12, no, 11.8 or 12. So I got it down to 10, and then I hurt my shoulder at the beginning of the year. So, yeah, it's moved up a little bit again. So it's around 11.8 or 12.
I still think that is better than most people would care to admit. But as I said, this is a safe space. I think this is a good handicap to have. Graham, before I let you go, final thoughts. If you could share one piece of wisdom with the ABB team you work with those that are listening to the conversation, with those that you have engaged with, perhaps customers in the past, what would that be?
Understand the responsibility that's been given to you by the organization. You know, it forms part of my leadership discussions often with a team. You know, we're given a certain responsibility, and we need to understand the power that brings, because the customer is relying on us. And, you know, simply sending an email or simply getting your little piece of the puzzle done and then standing back and watching it implode is not ideal. You know, at the end of the day, something that I'm teaching avidly in my existing role is there's always a customer standing at the end of this waiting for us. Yeah. So if your department has done their job right and the other three haven't, it's still a bad reflection on all of us. So, you know, just understand the importance of the responsibility you have been given from ABB, and you know, just make sure that the customer is waiting.
Responsibilities are to be taken seriously, almost as seriously as golf handicaps. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Graham for those insights and for the time. Lovely getting to know you, Graham. Graham Abrams, the Senior Vice President of ABB South Africa, joining us for this week's Executive Lounge.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain and the company's called Mesh Trade to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And just like that, folks, we've come to the end of the show. If you've missed any of the conversations, of course, they will be made available as a podcast after the show. I did put out a prediction in the National Pulse a little earlier that we would be back above $4,200 of fine ounce on the gold price by later today. And I see, as I look at the gold price at the moment, we're exactly $4,200 of fine ounce. So that should bode well for investors that have been holding on to their gold stocks, or those that are holding on to their gold in the form of perhaps Kruger Rands. But for now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means we're going to get ready to cross over to Greg Hose and the SAFM News team. They'll be followed by the award-winning sports show, the Top Sport Show, to give us a breakdown of what's been happening in the world of sport, which means from my side until tomorrow, good night.